towards the sound of a heron stepping on ice. February mist, morning thaw just begun, and the heron that is the same color of slate as the pond on which she moves, today is nowhere in sight. 2 days ago, my wife and I watched her hunting near the drainage pipe and heard at first nothing at each supple step. Then, just as her foot touched, a muffled creak of something giving way, her body's weight pressing at ice. We lost track of how long this lasted. Patternless, a few steps of audible silence, surface giving nothing back. And then, cleanly, sporadically, a tap of pressure on the ice's crust. She was stalking God knows what, moving on a pond frozen through, slow, determined, then lingering, affixed on something we couldn't see. A heron hunting tucks one leg back, lifts its neck, and with a sudden stab through air allows its body to unfold. This one, though, I've only seen take those tentative steps, lean in, wait implausibly, then begin moving again. What happened took place weeks after Isadora Duncan's children drowned, and isn't much of a story at all. This was after the driver turned the stalled car's crank, and the vehicle lurched and tumbled down the embankment, broke the river's surface, and was gone. Somewhere on a beach on Corfu, Duncan imagines the Seine's ribboned gray, its surge and gradual calm, and pictures hooks and dragging lines, an anchor snagged on a sun-glazed wheel. Then, although she's promised there will be nothing more, she watches her arm move. Wave froth, sand fleas, beach grass scruff, her hand lowered, raised. It seems perhaps like the first gesture she has made as she bends her wrist gradually back and makes what the body does willed. For a moment, almost mending evanescence, her body both forgotten and salved to itself, and then fastened to a way of saying that somehow seems to suffice. For years, a man born in a stubble field is satisfied documenting his walks. It is, he claims, our flawless art, just as it's perfect how dust freckles each lemon tree blossom, or how his horses stir in their decrepit stalls, watching rain pool in the dark palm of a shovel and in the earth between their hooves. These are moments the man considers too, as he drifts through the streets and hills, taking endless pictures of himself doing ordinary things, stark naked in each one. Catching his breath at a barbed wire fence, waiting for a passing mule, striding past a silo, scattering ravens, arms outstretched, leaping from a rock, sipping walnut brandy in the shade. A friend once tried to explain this to me, defining it in terms of dailiness, ritual, the precarious framework of the mundane. Think of Duchamp's urinal, I was told, or Rauschenberg's erased de Kooning, a piece in which absence, fixed in a gold leaf frame, becomes an end in itself, in which absence takes the form of a yellow sheet clumped with remnants of ink and crayon. It's not the same, is it, as that story of Pollock, most likely far from true, how he once bought a Picasso in order to erase it, to learn how the line might work, the way the body's dialect finds voice. Lead on cream paper, circa 1908, four studies of the human hand. Then his task filled hours, each fingertip, knuckle, wrist. In a photo taken somewhere in Russia, a crowd lunges towards a train window, eager for the papers offered by a boy, hardly caring their mostly lies. But now, here is the reason we look at it, why it was preserved. In the window next to this boy, someone has been painted out. Airbrushing, cropping, faces ink smudged or excised with a razor. It was all common, we know. Except here, the work is so poorly done, it looks deliberate. How the black of the window barely blends with the space where his body should be, and all of his contours are clear. At his torso, the oval construct of his head, each brushstroke is so thick and obvious, patterned in thumbprint whorls, it resembles proportion lines from some how-to-draw book. Symmetries, ratios, augmented angles, methods to ensure each of the parts is in harmony with the whole. It's as if whoever removed him from the scene was only beginning to understand just how the body works. Its axis, his shoulders, traversing lines, that single mark from scalp to ribs. Polycleitos knew the beautiful comes about little by little through many numbers, and perhaps with our rules for rendering ourselves, mimesis is nothing but math. Perhaps, too, this work was botched in order that we might notice, might begin to guess, that this man who stared down half asleep from the train was the same man who once seared his brother's eyes with a rust-flecked awl, then walked from his home without a word, who one night was made to kneel in the woods when his throat was slit beneath the pines. Done in one take, 40 seconds long, the first film ever made, Lunch Hour at the Lumiere Factory, shows only a crowd walking into sunlight, hurrying into a blazing lane. There's a rush of wool dresses, hand placed into a pocket, a shrug, a mastiff's fevered joy. Behind and above, back in the rafters, the pure geometry of light and wood. At the climax, a girl plucks at her button, and a black horse trots nimbly by, harnessed to a cart covered in canvas that gives back, as it passes, the shadowed branches of an oak. By now, it's December 1895. In a Paris basement salon, a crowd watches the image of a crowd projected on a pinned white sheet. A machine whirs and rattles along with the same effort of its name. Cinematograph, from the Greek, meaning writing the movement. They watch soundless blacksmiths striking at steel, the lift and curve of waves, and then a passenger train that glides into a station and seems to them, at least in one story, like artifice for a single breath more. Muybridge, I've read, invented moving pictures by making a horse circle a track. First, it galloped and broke each thread laced across its path, which in turn tripped the camera shutters and told us how it moved, how its body curved, lagged, compressed, and how there were moments, indiscernible, when not a hoof touched the earth. A few years after, he hunted down his wife's lover, playing cribbage at a Calistoga mine, and shot him point blank in the chest. Muybridge made naked dancers and gymnasts move against a grid of white lines. Here is a man walking and turning, a man heaving a boulder, carrying a rifle, digging with a spade, a woman drying her feet. Listen, there's no better time to finish one story I began before. It's about the artist who roamed the village hills, and I'm not even sure it's true. When war came, the man arranged to end his walks and put his camera away. Instead, he began to choose. He chose which of the dead he would allow to be buried, which Rottweiler, woman, which ear, to make some move barefoot towards an idling truck, then bedsprings, truncheons, stones. But listen, In one series of Muybridge photographs, a woman approaches a chair. She is naked in profile and beginning to move closer to its curved pine back. She's the same woman who pours a single glass of water, who stands after sitting on the floor. This time, though, she takes a few steps, kneels at a chair, pauses, then rises again. She has either a look of solemnity or a half-smile latched to her face, because she knows what she is about to do. By the fifth frame, we can see it, almost in entirety, and she touches it with her knuckle. This is a woman kneeling at a chair, and somewhere within or near the eighth frame, since this is all she intends, gesture and desire coalesce. She lowers her body, clasps her hands in one motion, bowing her head. And even if this lasts for just a fractured second, she seems to be honestly in prayer, as if not kneeling at, but to a chair, adamant, resolved, as if there were nothing else to kneel to, as if knowing in a moment she will be finished and begin to rise, but for now it is still not yet.